Respected guests, friends, young people, and brothers and sisters. The focus of our attention this evening will be on how peace will finally be achieved in the Middle East. And I was listening to a political commentator last week speaking about the problems in the Middle East. And he's a fellow from the old Ronald Reagan presidency, the Reagan administration, and his name is Mark Levin. And he made an observation that no one currently running for president in the United States is talking about a solution to the Middle East. He said they are presenting ideas to address small snippets of little problems, which may or may not help. But no one can explain how to resolve the problem itself. And he's right. No one is explaining how to resolve these problems because these problems are unresolvable by any man or government. It was shortly after Levin made these comments that Brother Lenny asked me for a title for this talk, and so I suggested the solutions to the problem in the Middle East. Now, what people are reluctant to say, and why no politician for sure will give a solution to the problem in the Middle East, is that the problems in the Middle East will never be solved until the world goes through what many are calling World War III, but which the Bible calls Armageddon. And many say World War III has already begun. The commentator I just quoted, Mark Levin, has been saying that World War III has been going on since the Arab Spring of 2012. The current Pope, Pope Francis I, said that the Paris attacks now 2 weeks ago began World War III. I heard several news people and commentators saying just a few days ago that as the Turk shot down the Russian jet, that it was piloted by Duke Ferdinand, a reference to the assassination of the Austrian prince in Sarajevo that was called the shot heard round the world and which started World War I. The perspective of the peoples as to what World War III will be like is interesting. The Pope, thinking that the Paris bombing started World War III, obviously sees it as a war of Middle Eastern peoples against Europe. Those who see it as the Turkish downing of the Russian jet obviously see a contest between the Western forces of NATO, of which Turkey is a member, and the Eastern forces of Russia. Mark Levin, who often has the clearest view on what is going on, sees it as a contest between the nations who back the Shiite Muslims on the one hand, and those who back the Sunni Muslims in Saudi Arabia and Egypt on the other. Levin said that a U.S. senator contacted him after the downing of the Russian jet and asked him what he thought should be done. He said he told the senator to stop the downsizing of the American military and immediately begin a program to restore the military to its previous size and strength. In other words, Levin told the senator what we read in Joel 3, verses 9 through 12. Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles. Prepare war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen, and gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause thy mighty winds to come down, O Yahweh. Let the heathen be wakened and come up at the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there will I sit to judge all the heathen round about. War is the only possible solution to the problems of the Middle East. And this seems to be a fairly uniform opinion of the world's political leadership, even if they don't quite agree on what the sides will be or how it should progress. And they are correct. There is no solution to the Middle East apart from war. And that we can say that with certainty because that is the scriptural teaching. But what are the sides to be? A former speechwriter to President George W. Bush observed the current lineup of nations a few weeks ago on Fox News. And he said, "Iran, Iraq, and Syria allied with Russia. Who could have expected this?" Well, the Old Testament prophet Ezekiel expected it some 2,600 years ago. He, along with the prophet Daniel, gave us the lineup of the nations for Armageddon. First, from Ezekiel, we learn in Ezekiel 38, the combatants of the Armageddon battle are mentioned. On the one side, the northern side, we read of these nations. In Ezekiel 38, verses 1 through 3, "And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal." And the revised version, which I have just below the authorized there, says, "Set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal." And we might say, what a bunch of funny and strange names. How can we possibly make any sense out of these things? Who are these people? Well, as it turns out, all these names, except Gog, are names of countries, and they are listed in the names of nations in Genesis 10. Following the Tower of Babel, as the nations migrated across Europe, they settled in different regions. Historians have traced their migration for us across Egypt and tells us where they settled. Magog and Gomer were the dominant tribes, and they, as they moved across Europe. Magog became the people of Germany and the German tribes, while Gomer were the French and settled south of the Danube. Rosh is the earliest known name of Russia. The Ross River runs through Russia proper. Tubal moved even farther north and still bears that name today, and the region is called Tobolsky in northern Russia. And Meshech, or Mosque, as it would be more properly translated, is the specific area of Moscow, and the Mosque River runs through it. So the nations that God is setting his face against in the battle at the time of the end are the armies of Russia and Germany and France and their associates. But peculiar to this current discussion, also with them we learn of these states. In Ezekiel 38 and 5, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his bands, and the house of Tagarma of the north country, with all his bands, and many people with thee. Persia is, of course, Russia's longtime ally and is modern-day Iran. Ethiopia is translated from the Hebrew word Cush. And there are two nations referred to as Cush in antiquity. The first nation so named was what we would today call Iraq. And the nation of Ethiopia being the second nation with that name. And, of course, Libya is self-explanatory. We have already pointed out that historians tell us that the tribes of Gomer became the tribes of France and Belgium and Luxembourg and nations like that. In other words, Gomer is the French-speaking people who settled south of the Danube as they migrated across Europe. Tagarma corresponds to modern-day Turkey, who is also very much in the news. So these are the nations which will set themselves in array against Jerusalem at the Battle of Armageddon. Did you know, talking about these things to people who were not Christadelphians just as recently as after 1990 was scoffed at. We were told, how ridiculous is that chapter? Everyone knows that the Iron Curtain there in Germany has come down. Russia's no longer our enemy. She may not even survive as a country and will certainly never be in a position again to come down against Jerusalem. And in fact, that is how it would have looked to anyone unfamiliar or unbelieving in Bible prophecy when the Berlin Wall was failing and Russia was bankrupt. Even as recently as 2012, in the presidential debates between President Obama and Governor Mitt Romney, Mitt Romney said that the greatest geopolitical threat to the United States was Russia. President Obama mocked him and said the 1980s were calling and wanted their foreign policy back. But what do we see today? Russia having invaded two countries, the Ukraine and Georgia. Russia threatening former client states of the old Soviet Union, such as Estonia. And Russia intimately involved in propping up its former client states of Iran and Iraq and Syria. And its leader, Vladimir Putin, telling us that the greatest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century was the fall of the Soviet Union. Well, where does Syria enter the picture? The United States President Obama has stated clearly that the longtime government of Bashar Assad must go, yet he is still in power and going strong. President Obama said that if Assad did certain things, such as use chemical weapons on his people, that the U.S. would become involved. Assad did all those things that he was told not to, but the U.S. refused to get involved. The price to pay for the U.S. would simply have been too high. And that's because Russia has such a vested interest in Syria. We learn of Syria's role in the time of the end from the prophecy of Daniel. In the 11th chapter of Daniel, Daniel the prophet speaks of a coming war between the king of the north and the king of the south. And the northern king's capital was Antioch in Syria, causing us to understand the important role that Syria will play to the northern forces in the war the Bible calls Armageddon. And this is why Syria has been so significant in the lining up of the nations. What the alliance of the northern Arab states have in common is their religion. They are all a type of Muslim called Shiites, or at least they are Shiite-controlled states. Iran and Iraq are both dominant Shiite societies with Shiite governments. Syria's governing body is technically called Alawite, but it is closely allied with the Shiites, which is why Iran takes such a close interest in Syria. The dominant religion of Syria is Sunni, and so the Shiites cannot allow Syria to change governments without destroying the militant arm against Israel, which is Hezbollah in Lebanon. Iran supplies Hezbollah directly through Syria. That is why, by the way, when Russia recently entered the war in support of Bashar Assad and his government just a few weeks ago, they told Israel that Syria was now a no-fly zone to Israel and to the United States. And the Israelis told the Russians, quite bluntly, no. They continue to monitor Iranian efforts to supply Hezbollah through Syria. So Russia entered the war, supposedly against ISIS, but immediately attacked the forces that were hostile to Bashar Assad, of which the United States was supporting. Russia's goal is opposite the goals of the United States. It is to support the Shiite governments and to keep Bashar Assad in power. Now, Russia takes such a deep interest in Syria for an altogether different religion or reason than the religion of those nations. Syria is the home port for any Russian naval activity in the Mediterranean. It is called the port of Tartus. It's right here. And it's just north of Lebanon on the Syrian coast. When the United States was threatening the government of Bashar Assad a few months ago, this was the picture from the port of Tartus. Those white, blue, and red flags are all Russian-flagged vessels, and the American-flagged boats going the other way were aimed toward that port. So yes, it is the prophets Ezekiel and Daniel who predicted this alliance of states. What is incredible is that no one in the political world today understands this. It's not that hard. These names may seem confusing, the ones we just went over, but just pick up an Encyclopedia Britannica and they're all explained. These names are no big secret. This was all taught in the world's history books till the late 1800s. Read the early expositors of any of the Protestant religions, and it's all there. It's just like Brother Jerry said on Friday night, at times it seems like the Christadelphians are the only ones still reading the Bible. We know that this isn't true, but how others read their Bible and are still surprised and shocked when the pages of the Bible read like current events is amazing. Now, as we mentioned before, the Pope said that World War III began this past week with the Paris bombings, or 2 weeks ago with the Paris bombings. And this he saw the Middle East in a confrontation with Europe. And he's not too far wrong. But it is not the Middle East in general who is at war with Europe, but just the southern Sunni Arabs, and in particular, the militant arm of the Sunnis, which is currently called the Islamic State. It is sometimes referred to as ISIS or ISIL, depending on who is speaking. ISIS means the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. ISIL means the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Now, the Levant, as a territory, is meant to imply far more than Syria, and it's far more ominous than just Syria. It is one of the names of the old regions of the Turkish Empire, and it includes Syria and Jordan and Israel and Lebanon. The name indicates the intent of the Sunni defenders to conquer all that region. Europe, with Russia, and even to some degree right now the United States, come to the attention of ISIS and the Sunni Muslims due to their opposition to the goals of ISIS. So there is clearly a hostility that the Pope is noting of the ISIS Sunnis against the intent of Russia to stabilize the Shiites in the Bashar Assad government in Syria. And that is why ISIS recently was involved in bringing down the Russian airliner leaving Egypt. They intend to terrorize Russia to get them to leave the region, just as the Paris bombings were designed to terrorize the European population so as to scare them from becoming involved in the region. Their terror will not work. Rather than serve to cause terror and stop the invasions, they are causing Bible prophecy to be fulfilled. As we said earlier, we know that Christadelphians are not the only group looking at the Bible prophecy and the current events and drawing conclusions. But when we hear the politicians speak of the prophecy, we are amazed at how they totally miss the picture. And the mistakes seem impossible to make. All seem generally aware that the wars which we are approaching are those wars prophesied in the Bible. All seem to be aware that the great enemy will be a figure that the Bible calls the false prophet, and sometimes the Antichrist. And all seem to be aware that this Antichrist figure is well defined in scriptures, yet somehow the politicians and political commentators manage to miss who this is. And largely it's because of the conflict between the Sunnis and the Shiites in the Middle East. Most of who comment on this is looking for the Antichrist to be an Arab. And they do this roughly based on the career of Muhammad. So they're looking for the Antichrist figure to come out of one of these two Muslim religions. Now, as a prophet, Muhammad was false enough, but he is not the false prophet of the Bible. You see, when it comes to the prophecies of the Antichrist, there are two women identified in Revelations. One is a chaste virgin dressed in white, which represented the bride of Christ. The other was a harlot, drunk with the blood of the saints. And this woman represented those opposed to Christ or Antichrist. Revelation 17 is a chapter which describes this harlot woman. We read there, "And he carried me away in spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations, even the unclean things of her fornication, and upon her head a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abomination of the earth." John, the recorder of Revelations, is amazed at the image and asks for an explanation. The angel which spoke to him told him in Revelation 17 and 8, "The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not, and yet is." Now, some of this language was quite mysterious about the beast that was and was not, and many questions arose about this beast. But one thing was quite clear. The beast went into perdition. Perdition means a loss of hope. It meant their salvation was jeopardized. And this was a powerful saying, especially considering that at that time, the entire world was in the Catholic Church. But it was immediately recognized to be a consistent teaching with another New Testament prophecy concerning the Antichrist. For instance, in 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 through 5, we read, "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition," there's that word again, "who opposeth and exalted himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Remember ye not that when I was yet with you, I told you these things." And as we said, there is that word perdition again. This time, Antichrist was called the son of perdition. So the Antichrist is clearly identified as a church which opposes the teachings of Christ. But there is a unique identifier in this section of verses. Paul says that the son of perdition was already at work in the ecclesia of his day, which would be somewhere in the time frame of 30 to 67 AD. Paul says further that this force would be revealed and would continue to exist until the return of Christ. In 2 Thessalonians 2 at verse 6 we read, "And now ye know that what withholdeth," that means restrained, "that he might be revealed in his time, for the mystery of iniquity doth already work. Only he who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. And then shall that wicked be revealed, who the Lord will consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming." Well, at the time when the Protestant movement was first underway, it was quite easy to identify this force. This would be around 1200 AD. There was, in fact, only one church who could be identified to fulfill this clue. There was only one Christian church in the world. There were no many religions and churches such as we see today. And so when the people came to realize that the only force that would have a continuous and unbroken line from the days of the Apostle Paul to the return of Christ, they knew that such a force could only be the Catholic Church. And the last few verses of Revelation 17 further clinched the identification of this force. In Revelation 17 at verse 18 we read, "The woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth." Again, there could only be one conclusion to this verse. What city ruled over the kings of the earth in John's day? It was Rome, the seat of the Pope, or the preeminent bishop of the world. This is the force which leads men into perdition, and her perditions have been many and varied. The specific teaching which first led men into perdition in the days of the Apostle Paul was the doctrine which has become known as Trinity. It is also called the divine mystery, because the teaching cannot be explained. And the churches are quite clear that it cannot be explained. It is the doctrine which claims that God and Jesus and the Holy Ghost are three entities in one and one entity in three. Their great example is that if you take three candles and put them together, you have one light. But their example breaks down that when you point out that there are still three candles, not one candle. And there is one light, not three lights. And this is why they call it the divine mystery. But the Apostle Paul calls it the mystery of iniquity. So who the Antichrist is not a matter that needs to be debated according to the signs of the times. Sure, it may look like to the world like it has to be an Arab today because of the conflict among the Arab states. But clearly, the Bible prophecy identifies it as Roman Catholicism. It is the very Pope who now feels threatened as the Sunni forces from the Middle East becomes more involved in Europe. How this ends is quite clear. It ends, as the prophet Ezekiel says, with the united forces of Europe, with the blessing of the Pope, backing Russia as she descends into the Middle East, backing those northern Arab individuals as they make war on Jerusalem. We have not reached that point yet, and just how we get to that point is not clear, but clearly the forces are in place to make it happen. There was an article shortly following the Paris bombings on how much support a group called Le Pen has picked up in Europe. Le Pen is a political party called a nationalist party. Really, they are the National Socialists, as was the Nazi parties of Germany in World War II, who opposed the policies of the European Union to allow this massive wave of Middle Eastern immigrants into Europe. And it is no secret that they are very fond of the anti-immigrant, pro-church, pro-nationalist policies of Vladimir Putin. The popularity of Le Pen rose from 18% of the French population before the bombing to 28% virtually overnight. And this nationalist movement is gaining strength throughout all of Europe. There is a national policy in every nation of Europe gaining power nearly every day now. In Germany, the National Party had crippled itself before the last election with internal fighting and dropped to merely 3% of the population. In the days following the Paris bombings, they were polled at 13%. And you know, when Nazi Germany conquered virtually all of Europe, they did it using what history calls the fifth column. The fifth column was large portions of the populations of the states they were attacking that actually supported the goals of Germany over the goals of their own country's governments. So when the Nazis invaded, a significant portion of the population looked at it as rather being rescued rather than invaded. And it made opposing the invading forces virtually impossible. Today's national movement in Europe is setting the stage for the same results. Many Europeans today would look at an invasion from Russia to be a salvation from the direction the European Union is forcing on them. Whether this is the course that the world history takes or not, we can't say with certainty. One thing we can say is that the United Nations of Europe, with the support of Russia and the Catholic Church, will soon descend upon the mountains of Israel to try and take control there. This is the force that will conquer Jerusalem. The scriptures are very clear about this. of the Narmies, the following verses are written. In Ezekiel 38, at verse 9, "Thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands and many people with thee. Thus saith Adonai Yahweh, it shall also come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought. And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest and dwell safely, all of them without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey, and to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon a people that are gathered out of the nations, which have gotten cattle and goods, that dwell in the midst of the land." The northern army finds little resistance as they sweep through Jerusalem and down into Egypt. Again, back to Daniel 11, at verse 40, we read, "And at the time of the end, the king of the south shall push at him," that is, the king of the north, that northern confederation, "and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon," that would be Jordan. "He shall stretch forth his hand upon the countries of the land, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps." And the vengeance of the northern invader against Jerusalem will be intense. Zechariah 14, verses 1 through 2. "Behold, the day of Yahweh cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city." Note that the whole city of Jerusalem is taken. Half of the people go forth to captivity. That point is sometimes being obscured by some modern commentators who say Jerusalem will not be conquered and only half the city taken. No, Israel will be totally and utterly destroyed with only a residue left. The title of our lecture is "The Solution to the Middle East Problems." So is this that we've just been talking about the solution? A victory by the Shiite Muslims through the help of Europe with Russia, defeating ISIS and her Sunni supporters? The domination of the Middle East by Russia, supported by Shiites and all of continental Europe? It is not. This is just the catalyst. These are just the events which must take place prior to the final solution for the Middle East and, frankly, for the world. But Russia's attention is not only on Jerusalem. She becomes greedy as she descends, and she goes to grab the arch enemy of Persia, which is Egypt. As God says in Isaiah 43, 1 through 3, "And now thus saith Yahweh that created thee, O Jacob, and that formed thee, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by thy name, thou art mine. When thou pass through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. And when thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee. For I am Yahweh thine Elohim, the Holy One of Israel, thy Savior. I gave Egypt for thy ransom, and Ethiopia and Seba for thee." I say Russia's intent is not on Israel. Well, actually it is. Socialism or humanism or any of the philosophies which argue that man can rule himself and that there is no God are always preoccupied with the Jews and with Israel. They know the promises that God made to Israel. Promises like we read in Jeremiah 46, verses 27 through 28. "But fear not, O my servant Jacob, and be not dismayed, O Israel, for behold, I will save thee from afar, and thy seed from the land of their captivity. And Jacob shall return and be in rest and at ease, and none shall make him afraid. Fear thou not, O Jacob, my servant, saith the Lord, for I am with thee. For I will make a full end of all the nations whither I have driven thee, but I will not make a full end of thee. But correct thee in measure, yet will I not leave thee wholly unpunished. The nations of the world realize that as long as Israel exists, they cannot claim their humanism to be an accurate religion. As long as Israel exists, it proves that God is continuing to work out his plan of salvation in the earth. And so the socialists and humanists of the world have as their ultimate plan the complete eradication of the Jews. As Hitler said to his generals when his generals complained that the trains were being used to take Jews to their death camp at the expense of the war effort, Hitler told them, "We must not forget that the purpose of this war is to destroy the Jews." So the Northern Socialists will want to utterly destroy the Jews, but yet God will cause something to happen in Egypt that refocuses Russia's attention there. And Egypt becomes the ransom paid to Russia that she will not destroy the Jews beyond what God intends for their punishment, to make them finally willing to accept Christ. And as the Russians drive down into Egypt, she either carries her forces or forces many of the Jews into Egypt before her. And it is this time that the real solution to the problem of the Middle East begins. Christ with his saints begin to engage this northern oppressor. You see, Jerusalem is Christ's. It is no one else's, no matter who holds it and usurps it. Jesus called Jerusalem the city of the great king. It was a quote from the Psalm 48 and 2. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion, on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. And the great promise from Isaiah concerning Jesus, so often heard this time of year, as Brother Steve mentioned in his talk this afternoon. In Isaiah 9 and 6 we read, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty El, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts," or Yahweh Tzvaoth, "will perform this." Now we might ask, where was the throne of David, where this king of peace is to sit? Obviously, that throne was in Jerusalem. But at this point, we have been considering, as we have been shown the prophecies of the Bible, that Jerusalem is in the hand of the Antichrist, the apostate Muslims, and the northern hordes. And those hordes have descended into Egypt, chasing and bringing captive Jews with them. And so the first thing that Christ does is to go into Egypt to lead the Jews who have been chased there out. We read this in Isaiah 19, 1 through 4. It says, "The burden of Egypt. Behold, Yahweh rideth upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt." That's Christ and the saints descending there first. "And the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. And I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, and they shall fight every one against his brother, and every one against his neighbor, city against city, and kingdom against kingdom. The spirit of Egypt shall fail in the midst thereof, and I will destroy the counsel thereof. And they shall seek to the idols, and to the charmers, and to them that have familiar spirits, and to the wizards. And the Egyptians will I give over into the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them, saith the Lord, Yahweh Tzvaoth." Egypt is given into the hand of a cruel lord, or to Russia. And to get her focus off Jerusalem, lest there be nothing remaining, as the socialists and Catholics strive to destroy, and Muslims, strive to destroy all the Jews to prove to themselves that God is not in control of these events. And so Christ and the saints descend into Egypt, not to interfere with the work that Russia is doing with Egypt, but to gather the Jews who have been chased there and to lead them out of Egypt and ultimately back to Israel. Having accomplished this, Christ and the saints, now called the rainbowed angel in the scriptures, leads the Jews out of Egypt. And that verse has many meanings, and now it has the ultimate one. In Hosea 11 and 1, when Israel was a child, then I loved him, and I called my son out of Egypt. That was true many times, coming out in the under Moses, and coming out when Jesus fled from the face of Pharaoh of Herod. And its greatest fulfillment will be Christ and the saints bringing the Jews out of Egypt and back towards Jerusalem. The Jews at this point are what we might call shell-shocked, having for several years no doubt been the victim of a terrible scourge, and now being led back to the scene of their destruction, they are of no use as a fighting vehicle, and they will not be called upon to fight for God. Hosea 11 and 11 says that they come trembling as a bird out of Egypt and as a dove out of the land of Assyria. But it goes on to comfort them and says, I will make them to dwell in their houses, saith Yahweh. Coming out of Egypt, Christ and the saints march along the same identical path as Moses did when he brought the Jews out of Egypt. We see this in Habakkuk. We read there Habakkuk 3 through 6. Eloah, the mighty one, came from Teman, and the holy one from Mount Paran, Selah. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. And his brightness was as the light. He had rays coming forth from his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. Before him went the pestilence, and fiery bolts went forth at his feet. He stood and measured the earth. He beheld and drove asunder the nations, and the eternal mountains were scattered. And the everlasting hills did bow. His going forth were of old. Now you will notice that the translators have translated this verse in the past tense. That is because to them, this was descriptive of Moses bringing the children of Israel out of Egypt and the path they took moving up towards Israel and finally entering into the land under Joshua. But their translation is wrong. The verse actually reads, God shall come in from Teman. It is in the future tense, but it shows us the path that Moses took and the path that Jesus will take are identically the same paths. And so Christ and the saints move out of Egypt back into the Sinai, where the judgment had taken place a few years earlier. Only now they begin to move into the battle arena. And in the first place they come in contact with the nations is in the southern Jordan, in the area called Basra. Basra is where many of the defeated powers have retreated to. And Russia's focus on collecting her ransom in Egypt has also given respite to the defeated forces. And Christ further intervenes to save them. When the children of Israel went by Basra, they were not permitted to fight with Basra because Esau was Israel's brother. And Daniel, or in Deuteronomy 2, verses 4 through 5, we read, And command thou the people, saying, Ye are to pass through the borders of your brethren, the children of Esau, that dwell in Seir, and they will be afraid of you. Take ye good heed unto yourselves, therefore, contend not with them, for I will not give you of their land, no, not so much as for the sole of the foot to tread on, because I have given Mount Seir unto Esau for a possession. So likewise, Israel's modern brethren, the United States and the Tarshish powers, will be preserved at Basra and delivered from the oppression of the Russian and European hosts. You know, the two nations with the closest voting record in the United Nations still today are the United States and Israel. And it was always amazing to me, even looking back in the USSR days, when the many Soviet Union states were only satellites to Russia, that the U.S. and Israel still had a closer relationship than Russia did with her conquered states. But Christ and the saints do fight at Basra, and they deliver a crushing blow to Russia, now Russia gaining her full attention. In Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 4, we read, Who is this that comes from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? This that is glorious in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. I that speak righteousness, mighty to save. Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel, and thy garments like him that treadeth the wine fat? He answers, I have treaden the winepress alone, and of the peoples there was no man with me. There was no man, no Jews. The Jews were not prepared to fight with them. They were still trembling and frightened from their previous experiences. So Christ and the saints says, yea, I trod them in my anger, I trampled them in my wrath, and their lifeblood is sprinkled upon my garments, and I have stained all my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. Christ and the saints of the rainbowed angel says, I have trodden the wide press alone, and of the people there were no man with me. The Jews that are with him are broken and a trembling mess. The southern king is defeated and of no use. Jesus and his saints only are able to stand up to the northern king and destroy this force at Bozrah and gain the attention of the fierce Lord busy collecting his ransom in Egypt. Continuing to follow the path of Moses, the rainbowed angel leaves Bozrah and moves up the east side of the Dead Sea through modern Jordan. And coming around the northern tip of the Dead Sea, he prepares to descend upon Jerusalem. Having now fully gained the attention of Russia and the European invading forces, they now see this force north and east of them coming to Jerusalem to engage them. Daniel says of this in Daniel 11, but he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And this is the king of the north. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. And he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and to utterly sweep away many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. Christ, rounding the top of the Dead Sea and preparing to attack Russia from her rear, are those tidings out of the north and out of the east which gain Russia's attention. And she drops back to marshal her forces, starting at En Gedi on the west side of the Dead Sea and south of Jerusalem. And how many are the prophecies of this great battle for Jerusalem? In Joel 3 and 9 we read, again, proclaim this among the nations, prepare war, stir up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up, beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Haste ye, come up, all ye nations round about, and gather yourselves together. Thither shall thy mighty ones come down, O Yahweh. Let the nations bestir themselves and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there will I sit to judge all the nations round about. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come tread ye, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for the wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of Yahweh is near in the valley of decision. And the sun and the moon are darkened. The stars withdraw their shining. And Yahweh will roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. And the heavens and the earth shall shake. But Yahweh will be a refuge unto his people and a stronghold to the children of Israel. So shall ye know that I am Yahweh your Elohim, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then shall Jerusalem be holy, and there shall no strangers pass through her any more. The valley of Jehoshaphat is the Kedron Valley, where Jehoshaphat, Judah's king, watched God destroy the force that came from the south against Jerusalem. That force, like the Russians, gathered itself at En Gedi, but then was destroyed by God while Jerusalem watched. And we can see how similar this will be to the battle from the days of Jehoshaphat. When those kings came up against Israel, they fought with each other till there was none remaining. And Jerusalem just watched their destruction. Ezekiel tells us similar things of this Russian king of the north who comes in the land. We read there in Ezekiel 38, 19 through 21. For in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath have I spoken. Surely in that day there shall be a great shaking in the land of Israel. so that the fishes of the sea and the birds of the heaven and the beasts of the field and all creeping things that creep upon the earth and all the men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence, and the mountains shall be thrown down, and the steep places shall fall, and every wall shall fall to the ground. And I will call for the sword against him unto all my mountains, saith Adonai Yahweh. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. Every man's sword, it says, shall be against his brother. In Zechariah 14, 3 through 4, we read, Then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those nations, as when he fought in the day of battle. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west. And there shall be a very great valley, and half the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. This tremendous earthquake sets up the shaking Ezekiel refers to, and sets up the confusion among the armies of the world who have assembled at Jerusalem. And the rainbowed angel has its great victory here at Armageddon. Armageddon is a word with perhaps several meanings. One of them is very applicable here. Arma, meaning sheaves, gay, meaning valley, and dawn, meaning judgments. This is the gathering of the sheaves into the Valley of Judgment, or Kedron Valley, south of Jerusalem, where Russia is vanquished and driven off ultimately to the north. Having attained this great victory, Christ and the saints turn their attention to Jerusalem to enter the city, but they find the residue of the Jews which have been left by Russia are not willing to allow a new invader, even the rainbowed angel who has provided for Jerusalem's deliverance into the city. Hence we see this discussion between Christ and the Jews who are still not willing to accept him. We read there in Psalms 24, 7 through 10, Lift up your heads, O ye gates, and lift up ye everlasting doors, that the King of glory shall come in. Who is this King of glory, they ask? Yahweh, strong and mighty, Yahweh, mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O ye gates, even lift them up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Who is this King of glory? Yahweh Tzvaoth, he is the King of glory. And Jerusalem does open her gates, or allow Christ and the saints to have access to wherever is standing following the earthquake. And so then, following taking Jerusalem, the saints ultimately fight one more battle in Armageddon or in the hills of Megiddo, being the site where Josiah was killed, and he gets his revenge against the nations. Russia is now completely vanquished from the Holy Land, and the march of the rainbowed angel is complete. So the political landscape of this time is that Christ and the saints have purified the land of Israel. We have the British American forces out of the land to the south, and the southern in Jordan, in Saudi Arabia and in Jordan. The Russian European Catholic forces are driven back into Syria, and Christ is reigning as king in Jerusalem. And there are many things that will happen next, but this is the picture that brings Jerusalem its salvation, which she will never again lose. We read there in Revelations 14, 1 through 6, And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion. And the lamb, of course, is Christ, the lamb slain from the foundation of the world, that we might have our sins forgiven and become part of that great multitudinous Christ man that makes up the rainbowed angel. The lamb stood on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their forehead. And I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters and as the voice of a great thunder. And I've heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung as it were a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which are not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which followed the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the firstfruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. Respected friends, guests, and brothers and sisters, we have the opportunity now to become a part of that great multitudinous Christ man part of these 144,000 that is symbolically a symbolical number referring to all the redeemed who will stand before Christ at the time of the end. These are the people who will provide the solution to the problems in the Middle East. As I say, we have the opportunity now to become part of that great man. But we have to take our actions seriously. We have to take our faith as the most important thing in our lives. We have to think in terms of, if Christ returns tomorrow, how important is any problem I have today? It simply is of no consequence whatsoever. And so we have to live our lives that way in these last few times. These last few days look like they're going to be quite trying. We're going to see Israel suffer terrible torment. We're going to see the nations around us engaging in little wars and skirmishes, possibly evolving into quite large wars. I was speaking to a friend of mine down in Austin, a fellow I do business with, and he was talking about the events going on in the world, and he said, "Isn't it scary?" And I thought right there, that's the difference between the way the world looks at things and the way we look at things. These things should not be scary to us. They should be exciting to us. They should be encouraging us to walk more perfectly the path that Jesus has set before us, that we might be part of that great multitude that provides the solution for the Middle East.